accession number 26561, Reel 6.
Wing Commander Bernard, Reel 6. Now, we're talking about when you'd moved rather dramatically to RAF Stranishore, and that was the end of the Whitley that you were using, I presume.
Yes, we had another one supplied, but we also got a rollicking. We said, well, if you're riding on a horse and you fall off, you're required to get back on the horse to get your confidence back. And Di Davis and I only had superficial wounds, facial and so on. And what had happened was that the pilot of that Whitley was in fact the Lysander pilot, who was used to the performance of a Lysander and could not, had never flown a Whitley before. He was trying to get his hand in, really. He was kicked off and sent away very quickly. And
so you all survived anyway.
Yes, surprisingly. The whole aircraft was a total write-off. It would do, you know, stalling at that height. It probably stalled at 300 feet, something like that.
And did you feel nervous? I mean, for your next flight?
A little apprehensive, yes. But we said, you know, you've got to get your confidence back. And Dave and I decided we would press on, because it was another thing. They'd got another Whitley, another Whitley by then. And the CO had us in and gave us a rollicking for volunteering to thing, but he hadn't got another pair of wireless operator gunners to do, but he still gave us a rollicking for, I think it was partly a relief on his part that we had survived this stupid young pilot that shouldn't have flown the Whitley.
So what happened next, sir?
We went on ops the following night, actually, and it was then that the CO heard that we'd been involved in the crash. We didn't meet up with him until then. But we continued with a series of operations. We were based at Stradishaw, but we'd always go to another airfield to pick up the Joe, and another airfield when we came back, we'd go to an entirely different airfield, not our own even, and then we'd go to our own. So to trace our activities would be very difficult if anybody was spying on us. And that went on for...
Any incidents before? Anything you remember?
During that, yes, at Stradishaw we were bombed again by the Germans.
What do you remember of that?
I remember it was one night this German aircraft came and bombed us, and in the sergeant's mess quarters, we had our own bunks, and Di Davis and I knew there was an air raid on, and we lived outside to a trench to watch, and we watched it, and the bomb that came down over our heads very close and finished up, and there was an oil plant that was used for processing, cleaning oil, and it blew that up. And the German pilot threw out his map with the route he'd taken and circled around Stradishaw. That was one. On another occasion, we did a whole series then of putting spies in, mostly France and Belgium. We were told, I asked on one occasion, why didn't we go to Holland? They said, you can't trust anybody in Holland. They're very much on the German side. So they abandoned putting any resistance people into Holland. But I came back from a trip and was sleeping in... I think it was the Friday the 13th was my 13th operation. We were very, very apprehensive that night, and we flew very high, and we flew to Brest. And the interesting thing, we put some spies in the outer area of Brest. And it's rather interesting that they were the ones that sussed everything out, ready for the Saint-Nazaire raid, which happened much later on. It was interesting to see where we put the spies in, big things happened. We were very impressed with their activities and admired them greatly. I came back from that trip and landed at Tangmere, which later on became a big spy place. We did our very first briefing at the ops room of Tangmere, and then subsequent times we sometimes came back to that airfield. It was very handy, and I got an empty sleeping bunk, and I was resting up after a night of operations, and I was woken with a stream of cannon shells, little cannon shells, right across by the dado and the monk, and I shot out in my pajamas, and I practically nosedived through the window into the slit trench. And subsequently, it was very interesting when they opened the Tangmere Museum, Tangmere Museum. The opening time, there was a German, a half colonel, and I was invited to that thing because of our activities. And he said, I was the one that staffed the on such and such a date. And he said, and two trips after that, I was shot down over England and became a prisoner of war for the rest of the war. But he and I met up in a friendly fashion. The fact that he'd put these shells into this sergeant's mess building that I was sleeping in. And I was a prisoner in his camp later on, and he'd a prisoner. And the Friday the 13th trip, we came back. Oh, no, it wasn't. No, that must have been another occasion when the shells became. Because we got back on the Friday the 13th trip, and we flew very high that night to put the spies in, which was successful. And when we came back, we were so overjoyed that Friday the 13th of September, I think it was, it wasn't an unlucky time. We went down to Chichester. Well, they couldn't get a room in any of the messes. So we went down to Chichester at about 4 o'clock in the morning and knocked up the landlord at the Dolphin and Anchor at Chichester and said, "Landlord, we want three bedrooms with twin beds in each and a crate of ale, please."
So you were pretty superstitious then?
Yes and no. I was never terribly so. I think I was a little bit. I've got a favourite scarf, which was my lucky scarf. I got it in the thing, and I think it was. I was a tiny bit superstitious on that, yes, but wasn't against Friday the 13th. What else happened on those? Oh, and then, of course, we did a whole series of operations. Altogether, to my total number of ops was 26, which is a lot for those days.
Any other specific instances? You know, things.
Yes.
Things
that well, out. I was a bit miffed with the not getting a reply to my call sign.
Tell me about that. This is your secret call sign.
The secret call sign. Well, they weren't. Yes, it wasn't announced. It wasn't put in the books of the DF stations, unfortunately. The base camp might have had it, but but they were the only ones. And whenever you called up for a call sign, you got a stony silence in reply. So I used to alter that, and I, whenever went near a thing, I'd go up to the Goodwood Races, which is above Chichester, and there was a DF station there, and I went in and said, "Who's on watch tonight?" And somebody said, "No, it'll be Bill." I said, "Well, leave a note for him. This is my call sign. If I call up for navigational help, you are to answer that call sign." And sure enough, and indeed, several trips afterwards, they did get my SOS shot down signal, which was quite good for because it was, we were so low when we were shot down. But we did the epic trip to Poland to put the spy.
Now that was January, wasn't it? 1941.
February 41. The trip to
February, yes, that's right. Sorry,
to Poland, yes. It was two nights after that I was shot down.
Now, what do you remember of this? I mean, that is a long flight.
A very epic flight. It was 12 colossal,
hours.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, we subsequently learned that Sikorsky and the Polish general, who was prime minister as well, and Churchill wanted to put SOE's activities, the resistance, into Poland, particularly in the Russian area, to find out what the Russians were into. They hadn't come into the war at this stage, and so we put three Polish spies on board. We had the aircraft modified, and I've still got the handbook on how it's done. The fuselage was filled with extra tanks for petrol, gasoline, fuel, and we worked out the route, which was circumvent Berlin, and then circumvent Poland, Warsaw, and then beyond that, and put the spies into that area, which is a long one. And there was a headwind that night all the way there, and if the headwind dropped, we would finish up in the Zuider Zee, because we didn't have the support of that headwind to get us back. And that's something like 2,000 miles in a non-heated, in the middle of winter.
What were conditions like in the aircraft? Can you give us an idea of the noise and just the environment inside the aircraft?
Oh, yes.
On a flight like that?
Yes. Well, first of all, Di Davis and I would take turn and turn about at the radio position and the rear turret. And because you couldn't stand more than 2 hours in that, you were absolutely frozen solid by then. Despite your warm clothing, it wasn't enough to stop you from getting frostbite. It was so cold in there, you'd take a bar of chocolate, which was your night flying rations, and break it, and it was a bit like barley sugar. You know, it had a glazed side where you broke it or smashed it, and a flask of hot coffee. It was noisy, smelly, but very, very exciting. It was take over those four guns in the rear turret, and when you tested them, the noise was colossal. Four Brownings rattling away at 1,000 rounds a minute each. That's 4,000 rounds a minute. It was quite a torrential shower of bullets, really. But didn't have the range that the German cannons had, was the problem. But it was quite a stick in the tail for that aircraft. The mid-under, of course, they did away with it. It slowed them down too much, but it made a useful position. Its circular hole made a good thing for putting spies through. And indeed, we heard that Ringway just formed after our time, and the all the expertise for dropping parachutes was really with our little flight, Van Halten.
Now, you said that you do a couple of jumps. I mean,
yes.
Before.
Oh yes. They were over the. We were volunteered for it because we thought, you know, if we got to do it, the Joes do it, and we can say give them confidence. It was interesting. They always, all the Joes had a flask each, and it was sort of half brandy, half cognac, and half coffee, and the whole aircraft smelt of this. These alcoholic fumes of the cognac, which was rather interesting. But the trip we did was from Henlow, not Halden. Henlow was the school for parachuting at that time. And in fact, there's a painting in there today of how the Vickers, Virginia, was used for training parachutes.
Now, what do you remember? We'll just drop this in the middle while we're on it. What do you remember of your own jumps?
Frightening. We'd had a very primitive briefing on this, how to keep your legs together and fall sideways, but no real training of any sort. This was training, and we took off from Henlow and flew to the Wash. And they had a marine craft section there who was out into the dropping area, and we eventually dropped into the water. They didn't want anybody to get broken legs dropping on the land at that time. It was a very early form of thing.
And you did just one or two?
Two, yes.
And what did you think? What was it like as an experience?
Well, it was a pull-off job. You sat in the tail of this, and they took the guns out and put a little platform with a sort of handrail. And what you did was you faced backwards, faced to the rear. The paintings in the mess at Henlow were bad because they got them out on the wings, but there was a risk of going into the tailplane. And indeed, on one occasion, with a drop for a spy, he went out through the underhatch, and there must have been an up current of something strange, and his chute was, his static line and his chute got tangled up with the tailwheel, which was not was under tractor, and we came back with him dead on the end of that another lot. I wasn't in that aircraft, but by now we'd got another crew, and there was in the aircraft this happened. So it was a danger with parachuting.
And what was it like for you when you jumped?
I was a little bit apprehensive, of course, yes.
Did you enjoy it at all? Some people enjoy it.
Yes and no. A mixture of both, yes. And the marine craft were circling with tenders, or whatever they call them, and they picked us up and took us back in fresh clothing and so on.
Now, getting back to this mission to Poland in February 41... so what you're on your way. It's a long way. I mean,
it's a very long way, and we knew the problem. If this wretched headwind dropped, we wouldn't make it back. And Di Davis was very, very upset. We had a night flying supper. They always gave us a good meal before we went on ops.
What was it usually?
Usually bacon and eggs and things that you didn't normally get in the ration days, and we got tucked into there, but he was very upset. He was more conscious of the risks, I think. I was sort of indifferent. I thought, you know, this is what I've joined for, this is what I must do. And but he was very, very, he couldn't eat his night flying supper. He was so worried about this trip. He knew it was a dangerous one. I knew it was too, but...
Now, was there much flak or night fighters during
the... Yes, and we were the only, I hear, we were the only ones that were flying over Germany that night, because it was a moonlight night. The bombers avoided moonlight nights. We had to use them because of our map reading and requirements.
So what happened, you know, what about the flak or the...
Yes, we the usual lot of going across the coast, and the Germans used to drop flares for the night fighter, German night fighters, red balls. We came across this very early on. We'd be covered with a series of red balls of flame, which floated there on parachutable flares, and that sort of marked us in the centre of that, and of course the usual searchlights as well. But if we just got the red flares, we knew there were fighter aircraft in that area, and the fighters didn't operate when the searchlights did.
Did you encounter any night fighters that flight?
Not directly, no. This always surprised me that, yeah, they were about, but they didn't spot us for some unknown reason. But anyway, the interesting one on this flight, we took off at sort of a dull, in the late afternoon, I think around about 5 o'clock, I think it was, and flew through, and we didn't get back again until daylight. So it was 12 hours, and the only way I found it was 12 hours was somebody had got an air traffic control log which booked us in and out of Stratishall.
Anything happened during it? So, or was it?
Yes.
I mean, it's strange to say routine for something the last 12 hours like that, but did anything happen on the flight?
Yes, I think the thing that impressed me, first of all, the spies hardly had room in the fuselage for extra petrol tanks that were there. A very uncomfortable 6 hours for them.
And there was more than one of them there?
Three of them, yes. Three Polish, which I subsequently met up with after the war.
And did you get any impression of what they were like?
We that was the thing. We trained ourselves not to look at them and not to do anything about it. If we knew them, we under torture, we couldn't tell anybody anything because we had never seen them. They must have thought we were a funny lot, indifferent. I don't think they realised that our behaviour was for their protection.
So what happened?
We flew around, we circumvented Berlin, which was blacked out, of course, and when we circumvented Poland, the whole thing was lit up like a giant star. It was most impressive. Nobody thought of aircraft getting that far. And the Russian border, and we came back. We landed.
There's no problem dropping them at all.
No, we found the right place. We were told that they were a couple of miles off the wrong field, but it wasn't. It didn't spoil the activity.
And what about the return for you?
We came back the way we had gone, you know, and we weren't shot down on that raid. And we were so chuffed with having done this epic flight to Poland and to the Russian border and back that we thought, gosh, you know. And the ministry rang up and said, we have another job for you. You can refuse it, having just come back from that tedious flight. Two nights later, you know, that night, and we got a night's sleep, and then we were on ops again. Sorry. sorry.
It's all right, carry on.
Yes, they said to us, the ministry, that we've got another job for you in Bel. We said, where is it? He said, oh, it's a short one. It's the moonlight's going, and it will be in February 17th, actually. We said, oh, yes, after going to the Russian border and back non-stop, Namur in Belgium was a kid's job, and that's the one that we were shot down on.
And was this to drop one or two spies? Just one?
Two spies into Namur, in the outskirts of Namur.
And what about this mission? What's your memory of that?
It was insignificant. We dropped the spies, and we always used to cover up our activities of spy dropping by propaganda leaflets, nickels they were called, and they were put out as a raison d'etre.
And what was in the propaganda leaflets? I presume they were genuine.
They were in French, and I didn't bother to read them, no.
How were they dropped?
Through the chute in the aircraft, an elastic band around them, and you couldn't drop them individually, so you dropped them with the elastic band down, and so they soon jumped out of that lot and fluttered down, and we were only at 300 feet when we dropped them over the town of Namur, and that's where the lucky, from German point of view, flak hit us.
Now, what's your memory of the time you were hit?
Yes, it was a dreadful rat-a-tat-tat noise, and we climbed out, and we were losing height all the time because one engine had gone and the other one was faulty.
They'd both been hit, then, or...?
Yes.
Had the body of the plane been hit?
We never discovered that because we crashed into a wood. We couldn't climb. We threw the Elson out, and the guns were unshipped.
The what out?
The toilet. Anything that was movable to sort of reduce the weight, and the four guns in the turret I undid and unshipped them over the side. And then the pilot said, oh, Jackie, Keist had taken over and somewhere through these. Through the middle of my ops, he became the permanent. His advantage was that he had been the pilot on the Hannibal, which was the big, with Imperial Airways, big biplane, and he knew most of Europe like the back of his hand.
Now, what was his name? Flight Lieutenant?
Keist.
Keist.
K-E-A-S-T-E. Keist.
And what was he like before?
He was a jolly character. I don't think he didn't have the leadership qualities even as the second Dickie. By this time we got another one. Jackie O'Toole had gone into hospital with some wounds from flak, and he took over.
That was on a flight you weren't on, I presume, that O'Toole got wounded.
O'Toole, yes, yeah. And He took over then, but...
No, so you were throwing things out of the aircraft?
Yes.
And falling?
And falling and being warned that we hadn't got any height and we couldn't sustain. And then the other, the last engine, it was only two engine job, Merlins, of course.
Now, was there any question of parachuting?
Oh, not at 300 feet, no, we didn't